So quick show of hands, how many of you, when you were a kid and someone would come up to you and you were playing a game or something, the very first words out of your mouth as they would do that were, "Not it," and would do that as a kid, okay, yeah, okay. How many people, when you pray for lunch, you're always like, "Not it," and then you have to touch your nose? That's like a weird, I don't know how touching your nose became the official sign for "don't pick me," but apparently that's a thing. Growing up, I was the fat kid on the playground, so yelling "not it" was essential. Because if I didn't yell "not it," I became it, and generally when I became it, I stayed it, and so the game is always a lot more fun when you are not it as opposed to being it. So I got really good. It, like, I could read your lips, and like I just see the T come out of your mouth for "let's play tag," and I'd be like, "not it," like you hadn't even gotten the words out yet. I'm already yelling, "not it, not me, don't choose me," okay? I find a way that I'm not going to be it. Now, I usually don't yell that as an adult. I think it's been a while since I've done that. But I still, from time to time, find myself yelling "not it." I just do it a little bit differently nowadays. Maybe you can empathize with this. Let me tell you a story. So I used to work for a church in Chicago area called Suncrest, and I was one of the pastors on our staff there. I wasn't like the lead pastor or anything, but I was a part of our executive team. And over the course of me being a pastor on staff here, we had a key staff member who had had pretty significant moral failure, and he had an affair, kind of, it was an online thing, and so as you can imagine, when that happens in the church world, that's like not a good thing at all. You know, that hurts a lot of people, and that's a really big deal that you have to lead through. And so we were trying to figure out as a team, we had this long, it was like a three and a half hour meeting where we're trying to figure out, how do you lead through this, you know, and all the kind of stuff. So, hey, what does this person's employment look like with us moving forward, okay? How do we help him, like, recover from whatever it is that, like, led him to make this bad decision? How do we help his family, right? Like, he made a bad decision, but we don't want them to feel, like, punished or ostracized or hurt in some way, right? They're hurting worse than the rest of us. And then, of course, questions about how do we lead through this? How do we tell the church? How do we guide people through grief and all this kind of stuff? And, you know, really heady kind of conversation. So the six of us around the table were kind of like the key staff leaders at our church, and we're trying to figure out all the answers to that stuff. And at the end of the meeting, we prayed some. We, you know, tried to get all the wisdom we could down the table. We were trying to figure out what we should do. And at the end of the meeting, we left, and I distinctly remember I'm pulling out of our church's parking lot, and I'm turning on the road to go home, and I remember thinking to myself, man, I am so glad I am not the pastor of this church right now. Because I thought about our lead pastor, a guy named Greg, guy I respect a ton, love a ton, and my day was over, his day was not, because this whole thing happened. It didn't necessarily affect deeply my particular area, though it was kind of, you know, casually affected, and, you know, obviously touched some things in my area, my purview, but it was going to be way worse for him. You know, he was going to have to be the person who would, you know, make some pretty hard phone calls, and he was going to have to hurt some feelings, and he was going to have some really hard conversations, and he was going to have to guide some people through grief, you know, which is not easy. And it wasn't like my friend Craig, you know, wasn't like, he's like, man, I got all this bandwidth, all this extra time, I've just been looking for a place to use it, you know, he's busy just like the rest of us, you know. And I remember just driving down the road being like, man, thank goodness I'm not the lead pastor of this church. And God was up in heaven just laughing and laughing and laughing. He's like, just you wait. We all have experiences, I think, where we go, not it, not it. I was having dinner with someone this week, and they were telling me about a situation they're walking through in their lives right now where they're waiting on a health diagnosis. And they've had this problem that's been plaguing them and giving them trouble for a while, and it kind of is reducing their quality of life, and it's just making them feel like a shell of themselves. And the most frustrating part isn't just that, hey, we don't know what's wrong yet. It's like, no, I've seen the professionals, I've seen the experts, and they can't figure it out. They're looking at me like, yeah, we don't understand. We don't know what's wrong. And some of you have been there. Some of you have loved ones who have been there, and you know that's not a fun place to be. That's not an easy place to be. And they're trying to figure out, you know, hey, how do we move forward from this? How do we lead our family forward from this? How do I honor Jesus through this? You know, how do I lead myself into a place of hope where I'm just not perpetually hopeless all the time because I'm experiencing this? Some of you have experienced that. My wife and I are godparents to this little six-month-old girl named Amori. And Amori's mom has become a friend of ours, and I think it was kind of a surprise, you know, when she found out she's pregnant and it wasn't something they were expecting, but her and her baby's dad were kind of figuring out, okay, hey, we're going to co-parent, we're going to raise this kid together, we're going to figure this out. And along the way, he just made some really stupid decisions, and now he's in jail. And now our friend is trying to figure out, not just like, hey, how am I a new mom? You know, I'm in my early 20s, and those of you who are moms in the room, you know, like, when you had your first kid, you weren't like, I know exactly what to do all the time, you know? You're trying to figure it out. You're trying to sort it out. And so she's trying to sort that out on top of, hey, how do I do this with one income, right? How do I do this as a single parent? How do I arrange for care for my kid? You know, my family's in Orlando, and I'm up here. What am I doing with that? And we've kind of watched her go through a situation where I think, you know, if she had the option, she'd be like, not it. You know, like, I'm not envious of this, right? I'm not looking to do this. All of us have not it situations. You have a job loss that you have to work through. You have a financial hardship that you experience, a medical bill that you don't know how to pay. You know, you found it, maybe like our friend, right? You found out, oh, we're pregnant, and we kind of thought we were done being pregnant now, or we weren't ready to be pregnant right now, right? Maybe you have some friends, and you had kind of a close friend group, and all of a sudden there was a falling out, and it just grieves your heart because you kind of feel caught in the middle. You know, you want to see them get back together again. You want the relationship to be restored. You want things to be okay, and you don't know what to do. Maybe you're in a situation at work where something shady is going on, and you know someone needs to talk about it, and someone needs to call a spade, and someone needs to, like, have the honest conversation with your boss or someone at work. And everyone around, like, knows it needs to happen, but no one wants to be the person that makes it happen, and you're feeling the tension of that. Some of you are in a marriage, and the marriage isn't the way you thought it was or should be, or the relationship isn't how you wished it was. Maybe you found out some new information about someone or something that you didn't know before, and now you're in that awkward position of trying to figure out what to do with it. You know? All of us, guys, at some point or another, we're either in the middle of a situation where we think, not it, you know, or we are hurtling toward the next situation where we want to go, not it. Okay, here's kind of how I framed it for us. This isn't the most hopeful thing probably, but not it is an inevitable reality of life. You and I are going to find ourselves in positions just inevitably where we are going to think, not it. Like, I wish I could opt out. I wish I could say uncle. I wish I could be like, Jesus, not it. Like, I don't want to be in this. I don't want to work through this. Like, I feel caught in the middle. I'm not sure what to do. Jesus actually said these words. These were just literally an hour or two before he got arrested. Jesus said these words to his disciples, his closest followers, okay? He said, I've told you these things. He's just told them a bunch of stuff about God in this final time they have together, so that in me you might have peace. In this world, you will have trouble, to which some of you who aren't even followers of Jesus, you're like, wow, Jesus really nailed it on the head with that one, right? In this world, you're going to have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Now, I'm here to tell you, if the Son of God says you're going to experience some not it kind of circumstances, I feel pretty confident in predicting all of us in this room inevitably are going to feel some not it kind of circumstances. And when we experience not it in our lives, it requires this word, courage. Courage. And what I've noticed, maybe this is just me, but I don't think it's just me, is I never think of myself as like a super courageous kind of person. I always think of, like, that's someone else out there, you know, like that's some like big shot CEO kind of thing, or that's like maybe like a military general going out on the field, or an admiral or something like that. Maybe you could look at like a president or celebrity or something like that, you know, over the course of our nation's history or something that you think like, wow, they're a leader. Yeah, they're courageous. They know what they have what it takes. And I'm just little old me, you know, like I don't really know what to do. I don't really know what to say. I feel like I'm probably going to mess it up, you know, and I don't feel very courageous. I don't feel very ready to tackle whatever the not it is. And that's framing for us the next 4 weeks that we're going to spend together. We're going to look at the story of a woman in Scripture named Esther. And Esther, as a teenager, or maybe early 20s at the oldest, has this crazy rags-to-riches kind of tale where she just moves from being a nobody to the queen. She's like the ultimate somebody. And what's interesting about Esther is if you met Esther, you would think, here's an average, ordinary girl. There was nothing about Esther that you would be like, wow, future president right there, future senator, you know, future CEO or board of directors chairperson or something like that. Wow, there's a girl that's going to write her best-selling New York Times leadership book or something like that. You would not think that if you met Esther. What's interesting about Esther is that she, I think, shows us what courageous leadership looks like for the rest of us, that she models for us what it looks like for average, ordinary people who don't think there's something special about themselves, who don't look at themselves as these amazing, courageous, yeah, go get them kind of leaders, that her story actually instructs our story because it shows us how we can venture through not it circumstances and our kind and our lives in a way that is able to make a difference, is able to lead and to act with courage. And so this week, I want to start to lay the groundwork for that. I want to apologize in advance because this week's message is a lot more like history lesson kind of thing. So some of you are like, yeah. A lot of you are like, oh, yeah. So I'm going to try and make it as interesting as I can. Please laugh at all my jokes and it'll make it way better for me. Maybe not for you, but it'll make it great for me. Esther's story is covered for us in the Bible in the book that is called Esther. Shock, you know, who saw that coming? So Esther's story in the book of Esther happens, and Esther's story actually opens up with a guy named King Xerxes. Xerxes is the king of the empire of the Medes and the Persians. They're like the world superpower at this point. They're the big man on campus. And Xerxes is basically an oversized frat boy, if you kind of read the story and know anything about him. And so Xerxes begins, and he's getting ready to, history tells us, to embark on this military campaign into Greece. He wants to conquer some new territory for his kingdom. And he knows if he's going to do that, that's going to be a very costly effort. He's going to need a lot of buy-in from people whom he's going to have to ask to, like, fight in this war for him and that kind of thing. So for about 6 months, Xerxes has like this, I don't know, it's like this Xerxes party kind of deal where just like through the streets of the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, he like marches through, like, you know, it'd be like the equivalent today of marching through like all your tanks and cool, like, you know, items of war and all that. Like, look how awesome we are. Look how great our kingdom is. Look at all this kind of stuff. And he marches all that through to kind of like gin up some enthusiasm. And he ends this 6 months with a 7-day banquet in Susa, the capital of the Medes and the Persians. And the whole point is basically like, hey, you can come and eat and drink as much as you want. Like, he's just being excessive, like as generous as possible. He's inviting people just to take and have whatever they want. And at the end of these 7 days of feasting and revelry and all this kind of stuff, we're told that this happens. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, so that's what they're calling it these days, apparently, a very spirited individual, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him, people whose names I'm not even going to try to pronounce to you right now, you can do that yourself, to bring before him Queen Vashti, the queen, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles because she was lovely to look at. Now, there is no shortage of Hebrew scholars and rabbis who've said that whoever the writer of Esther was, whether it was Esther or her uncle Mordecai, who we'll meet here in a second, or some other ancient historian who just wrote these events down for us, we're pretty much told that the idea that Xerxes says, hey, come out wearing your crown, it would probably be better understood as, hey, Queen Vashti, come out wearing only your crown, please. Now, ladies, I know that the idea of just walking, prancing around naked in front of your idiot drunk husband and his idiot drunk friends sounds really appealing, probably. Queen Vashti sent back word saying, I don't think you're ready for this jelly. And so she was not having any of that. So Xerxes, being ever the feminist that he was, did not take that very well. And so he responded by banishing Vashti from the kingdom. And he wrote this new law while drunk, which is, you know, really great. Drunk legislation, I'm sure, is the best legislation, where he said, basically, hey, all the women of the kingdom, you have to be subject to the men of your homes, and you have to do whatever they tell you to do. So hashtag feminism is Xerxes' thing right here. Xerxes goes off to war. He fights this 4-year military campaign in Greece. He comes back. And the campaign did not go well. You can read in history books about that, but basically he got humiliated on the battlefield. And his army sustained a lot of losses. And so he comes back home. He comes back to his palace in Susa. And he's already smarting from having this really bad military loss. And now he comes back home and he's reminded, oh yeah, that's right, I got rid of the queen. And it was like this really public, like shaming kind of thing that like really was a hit to my honor. And so like he's kind of, now he's really hurting. And so all of Xerxes' attendants walk up to him and they say, hey, we have a great idea. Let's do Persia's next top model. We'll get Tyra in. She can host for us, okay? And so basically they decide that they're just going to take all the beautiful young virgins from all around the kingdom, and they're just going to seize them for the king. And that one by one, they're going to parade into his bedroom night after night, I'm sure just to get to know each other's lovely personalities and, you know, learn what your favorite book is or something like that. And then at the end of this process, he is going to select the new queen. Now, this is probably going to be surprising to you from what you know of King Xerxes so far. He loved this idea. He thought this was a great idea. And so he's like, well, pip, pip, guys, let's go. You know, let's do this, all right? So they go around. They take all these people in. And this is where we meet our heroine. We meet Esther. Esther was actually born under a different name. Her name was Hadassah. And Hadassah, two parents both died. We're not sure what happened. We're not sure what went on. And she is an orphan. And so Hadassah is taken in by her uncle, a man named Mordecai. Now, we don't know a whole lot about what Mordecai did, but we understand that he had some sort of job where he was connected at the palace. He was always around the palace in Susa. And so he took Hadassah into his home and raised her, and he actually changed her name to Esther. And the reason that Mordecai gives to Esther for why he changed her name is essentially, Esther, no matter what happens, you cannot let people know your nationality, because Esther and Mordecai were Jews. And it's never specified for us what exactly in the book of Esther, but it becomes very clear that the Medes and the Persians were not fans of the Jews. And if you were a Jewish person living in the Medes and the Persians' kingdom, you were subject to hatred and discrimination and violence. And as we'll get to the end of the story, someone in the kingdom very high up actually tries to basically lead like ethnic genocide against this group of people. So not exactly a great environment. Good to know that 25 years later, we've really learned from history's mistakes and we don't judge people based on, you know, stupid stuff like that anymore. Nervous laughter in the room. So Esther kind of gets raised up. She's beautiful. We're told she's extraordinarily gorgeous, and she is rounded up as part of this whole beauty pageant for the king. And so, like I said, one by one, they're kind of marched into the king's room, you know, so he can have his way with them or whatever. And we're told that when the turn came for Esther, the young woman that Mordecai had adopted, daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go into the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch in charge of the harem, how'd you like to have a business card with that on your title there, suggested. Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. Every time people meet Esther in the book of Esther, we always see that descriptor. There was something about her that people just loved. They wanted to be around her. They liked her. They rooted for her. They thought she was a really cool person. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and here we see it again, she won his favor and his approval more than any of the other virgins. So at the end of this whole charade, he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So again, Esther, this teenage girl, has went from being nothing to something in record time. I cannot imagine like how drastic that transformation would be, like to have that happen to you. But her story ends with a little bit of a note of foreboding. A couple verses later, Esther had kept secret her family background and her nationality, just as Mordecai told her to do, because she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Agag is a great place this time of year, I hear. He elevated him and gave him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. So Haman basically gets a promotion. He becomes the king's number two guy. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, which it's easy for us to pass this over, But the fact that the king had to tell people, hey, make sure to honor Haman, make sure to bow before Haman, tells us that Haman was a real tool, because that's the only kind of person you had to say, hey, make sure to be nice to him. You know, like that's the idea. Everyone resented this guy, but apparently it takes one to know one. So, you know, Haman kind of gets honored and all this stuff. But Mordecai, Esther's uncle, would not kneel down or pay him honor. So when Haman saw Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. He could not believe this. But having learned who Mordecai's people were, that he was a Jewish person, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. And so instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. And what we're told a few verses later after this is essentially Haman kind of sweet-talks the king into signing this piece of legislation. Apparently he hadn't learned his lesson from a few years before. They basically said, hey, on some arbitrary date in the future, everyone in the kingdom is allowed to attack the Jewish people. You're allowed to massacre, murder them, kill them, take all their stuff, okay? Basically, we're just gonna clean house. We're not going to have any of these people as a part of our kingdom anymore. Esther is a Jew. And now Esther finds herself in a really weird position. Yesterday, she was just like going to a Taylor Swift concert and like, oh, that was so much fun. You know, oh man, my American history class is so hard. You know, well, she probably didn't say that because it's 500 BC, but my Persian history class is really hard, you know. And she's like all worried about that. You know, she's just a typical teenager. And now out of nowhere, she's the queen. Like she's an important person in the land. And she is confronted with this problem that she could have never imagined. She finds herself smack dab in the middle of this evil plot to exterminate her people. What would you do if you were Esther? Where would you start? What would you do? Esther, up to this point, one of the interesting things, if you read the first couple chapters of Esther, through the first four chapters of Esther, she doesn't say a word. Esther is totally passive. Again, Esther is just like, she's just a quiet, compliant, you know, kind of nice, you know, gentle-mannered kind of person. You know, she is not a person where you'd look, man, ferocious leader, right? Like, she's just a kind of a just quiet, demure individual. The whole first couple chapters, she's treated as an object, right? She's always listening to her uncle, and then she's kind of whisked away and taken to the king, and then she's listening to the king and listening to all the nobles, okay? Like, she's just passive in this first part of the story. She is not a grab life by the throat kind of person, apparently. And now Esther is thrust into this difficult and challenging position. And in fact, if someone came up to Esther, as they will next week, and say, hey, Esther, you should do something. And Esther's response is, I know I'm the queen, guys, but let's not act like I became the queen because I'm an excellent leader and administrator, right? Like, let's not act like the king chose me because I proved myself as this amazing person, right? He chose me because I was easy on the eyes, I was good in the sack, and I wouldn't talk back like the old queen used to, right? Like, that's why I'm here, okay? But yet Esther is the person that God uses to save his people. Esther is the person that is leading the charge to do one of the most impactful things possible. Esther's story ends with her saving the Jews, and to this day, Jewish people celebrate this festival called Purim. And it's the story of Esther saving and rescuing God's people. Now, Esther, the book of Esther, has one interesting literary feature, and this is where I want us to camp out for the last 10 minutes or so here today. The book of Esther has an interesting literary feature. It's the only book of the Bible that never mentions the name of God anywhere. And in fact, it's kind of interesting because at several points in the book of Esther, the writer is going to talk about people praying and people fasting and people kind of like doing stuff that you would associate with God. And the writer actually goes out of their way to like make sure they don't say God's name. And it's a literary device. It's not like they got to the end of writing the book of Esther and like, dang it, I forgot God again. Oh, yeah, I hate it when I do that, okay? Let's strap it. We got to start again, yeah? The writer of Esther is trying to make a very salient and very important point. And this is all I want us to camp out on today. The point is this. God is always at work behind the scenes. God is always at work behind the scenes. Esther's story has this all over it. God was at work in King Xerxes deciding to go to war with Greece and the ensuing decision to throw a banquet to gain support for this war in Greece. God was at work in his drunken request for his wife to striptease him and his drunk buddies, which is probably the only time in the history of mankind we've been able to say, wow, look at God at work in those drunk guys looking for a strip club. You know, like no one's ever been able to say that before, right? But God is at work there, right? God's at work in Queen Vashti's decision to say, I'm not doing that. And God is at work in Xerxes' immature decision to decide, well, I'm done with you right now. God is at work in Esther's life. He's at work in the natural beauty and gifts and winsomeness about her. God's at work in the bad part of Esther's story, right? Esther's parents dying and her being an orphan led to her being adopted by the very connected Mordecai, who will be a very key figure later in the story. God was at work in Esther's good impression that she made on everyone who met her. And of course, God was at work in Esther's becoming the queen. God was at work in the nationality, in the people that Esther was born into, because I can't imagine that someone who was not a Jew would be that concerned in this culture about the fate of people that were not her own. God is at work all in this story, and yet never at any single point does the writer of Esther draw our attention to God's overt action in this world. Because isn't that how life kind of works? Here's the thing about God being at work behind the scenes. Is it's behind the scenes. You don't see it. You don't notice it. You're not privy to it. That's what makes it behind the scenes. And the point, I think, that Esther's story is meant to give us, the reason that it's a part of the Bible, even though it never actually mentions the God of the Bible, is because God is trying to make this point to us of, just because you don't see me doesn't mean I'm not there. Don't mistake my silence in your situation for absence from your situation. I'm at work, I'm just behind the scenes. Right, if you ever go to a play or some kind of show where they have like they have to change the scenery and stuff in the middle of the act or something like that, good stagehands and people who do all that, they don't wear like neon yellow when they come out on stage to move stuff around, right? They wear black, right? Because they are unseen, right? When they walk out on the stage, they don't go, hey, don't mind me, I'm just moving this tree, you know, whatever it is, you know, like they're quiet, right? Because they understand I'm working behind the scenes. Here's the proposition I want to make to you today. What if God is at work in your life behind the scenes? What if the not it thing, the thing that you kind of, God, I don't know why you're letting this happen. I don't know why you dumped this on my plate, but not it. I'm not interested. I didn't sign up for this. I don't want to do this. Not it. You know, not it, not it, not it, not it, not it. How would your response change if you knew God was at work? If, in fact, you just took it for granted God was at work, you just didn't see it. I don't know how you would respond, but I know in my life, when I think about the situations where I'd rather opt out and God, I think, wants me to opt in, that what's interesting to me is I feel like I'd be a lot more courageous. I'd be a lot more eager to dive in. I'd be a little bit more confident in the way I carry myself and the way I act if I just assumed God was at work and I just wasn't, you know, wise and all-knowing and clairvoyant enough to see it. I have a feeling God might be doing the same thing in your story. Because the same God in Esther's story is the same God in your story today. 2,000 years ago in Rome, Paul, the first century church leader, would write these words to Roman Christians. Now, I just want you to put yourself in the shoes of the average Roman Christian, okay? Christians in Rome, Emperor Nero was ruling at this time, and Emperor Nero was not a big fan of Christians. He's the guy that burned down Rome, and he blamed the Christians for it. Emperor Nero was the same guy who, when he would be having a party in his back garden, he would just round up a bunch of Christians, and he would tie them to a stake, and he'd douse them in, like, accelerant, and he'd light them on fire, and they would be the torches at his dinner parties. So how would you like to go to one of those dinner parties? That sounds very interesting. That does not sound like an environment where I would like to be a Jesus follower. I would definitely be a not it in that situation. I'm not interested in that. And here's what Paul, the first century church leader, writing to these very Christians experiencing this, here's what he says. He says, "We know," as in, it's certain, as in, you can take it to the bank, as in, you can act and always believe and always understand that this is true. Like in the same way that you know 2 + 2 = 4, you can know what I'm about to tell you is true. We know that in all things, good things, bad things, innocuous things, hard to understand things, confusing things, tense things, anxious things, scary things, we know in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. Here's what Paul says. You can know, you can take it to the bank, whatever you're experiencing, whatever you're walking through, whatever you're struggling with right now, you can know God is going to use this for the advancement of his kingdom in a broken world. You can take that to the bank. And Paul's encouragement to Christians back then, and I think Christians today, is, so let's just live like that's true. Let's just assume that's true. I simply have two questions I want to ask you to think about this week. Number one, I just want to ask you to think about, what's your not it situation? This series is probably only really going to be helpful if you identify something in your life that isn't like going toward plan right now. So what's the not it? It doesn't have to be serious. It doesn't have to be like this life-defining thing. It could be. It could be, hey, you know what? I've got a team member at work that I know I need to talk with and have this hard conversation with, and I've just been kind of putting it off. It could be, hey, you know what? I've been thinking about making a job change, and I've just been kind of putting it off, and I don't want to do it, and it feels weird. And it could be that family member. And you know for years that this thing has been an issue, this problem, you know, and I just didn't want to confront it. It could be a financial thing. It could be, hey, there's kind of an elephant in the room in our marriage, and I know someone should talk about it, and I would love that to be the other person in the marriage, not me, you know, and I just want to not deal with that right now. Okay, what's the not it? You know, what is it? Think about that. And then the only question I want to ask you to think about this week in regard to that is, how would your actions and emotions change if I assumed God was at work? If I assumed God was with me? If I assumed that while God may seem absent in this situation, he is actually present. He's just behind the scenes. Not it situations are scary. At no point in this series am I going to tell you, man, come on, you pansy, you know, like, just pull your pants up, you know, like, you can do this. I know it's hard, but whatever, you know, who cares, you know, cry me a river, you know, or whatever, like, you know, your grandparents would say or something like that, okay? This is not a series about that, because it is hard, and it is scary, and the reason that you need encouragement to do it is because it requires courage to do it. But together, I believe God wants to use your not-it situations to make a change in this world, in the same way he did with Esther. Whether that changes one person or thousands of people, the impact is important enough for him to entrust you with it. God is always at work behind the scenes. He was always at work behind the scenes in Esther's life. He was always at work behind the scenes in the lives of the Roman Christians that Paul wrote to thousands of years ago. He's at work in your life too. And the Queen's story is a beautiful demonstration to us of how we get to watch that. Let me pray for us. Father, I thank you for this story of Esther, and I thank you for you entrusting this to us as part of Scripture. And Jesus, I pray for this morning for you to help us to identify the places in our lives where you are calling us to make an impact and to make a difference. Jesus, I pray we would lean into those areas in a way that makes you proud. I pray we would lean into those areas in a way that, God, that advances your kingdom. God, help us to have the clarity of mind and heart to be able to see that you are at work, even if we don't see it. God, give us the wisdom to identify what it is you're calling us to do. And God, over these next couple weeks, give us the courage to take a next step to do it. Pray this, Jesus, in your mighty, powerful, and matchless name. Amen.